Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks to all of you who made a contribution to WNYC in the last hour to keep the radio station going. Brooke Gladstone will be back to help me talk more about that later in the hour. If you have not yet, we hope you'll do it right now at 1-888-376-9692 or online at WNYC.org. Thanks so much to all of you for making this possible. And right now, something very special to me, and I hope to some of you. 15 years ago, on Martin Luther King Day, 1993, the tennis star and humanitarian Arthur Ashe called into this show, humbly so, just as any other listener. We were comparing Martin Luther King and Malcolm X that morning, and Arthur had something to say. I later learned that Mr. Ashe was calling from the hospital where he was being treated for AIDS, and he died just 3 weeks later, 15 years ago last week, February 6th, 1993. Now, as it happens, we learned recently that Arthur Ashe's wife, the photographer Jeannie Mutusami Ashe, has launched a not-for-profit website, arthurashe.org, that preserves the legacy of her late husband by collecting memorabilia, sponsoring an essay contest for kids, and other things. So we contacted Mrs. Ashe to offer her a recording of Arthur's call to the show for that website and to come on the air with us today, if she was willing, to help us replay the 11-minute phone call and put it in the context of Arthur Ashe's life. So we will talk to Jeannie Ashe in a few minutes, but let's listen to the beginning of the call. This, again, was Martin Luther King Day, January 18th, 1993. We had a guest, James Cohn from the Union Theological Seminary, who had written a book called Martin and Malcolm and America that compared Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And then, much to my surprise, let's go first to line three. I see, actually, that we have a very special caller. Arthur Ashe is calling us up this morning. Good morning, Mr. Ashe.
Morning.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I thought the show was very interesting, and listening to the tapes, I heard one segment from Dr. King, which is dear to my heart, and that is the one that says, let's not satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness. I remember that and know it by heart already, and certainly it's something that I try to live by.
And how does the legacy of Malcolm X sit with you?
Well, I was at UCLA, and you heard Dr. Cohen talking about the Watts riot. I was at UCLA, a student there, started in 61, graduated in 66. So I was very, very aware of the buildup to the Watts riots in 66, and I'm not at all surprised that we had another revolt last spring. But we talked about Malcolm. When I say we, I'm talking about the African-American contingent there, as well as some of the African students, because UCLA always had a very strong African presence. We talked about Malcolm a lot, I would say just about every day. And I agree with Professor Cohen that it was done in the context of the times, because the Anglophone and Francophone colonies in Africa were in the process of being granted or winning their independence. And we certainly made comparisons or analogs between their experience and what was going on with us. I am a Southerner, born, bred in Virginia under segregation. I certainly understood it. But as a Southerner, listening to Malcolm X, I was really turned off by him at first. I thought he was actually frightening. I remember talking about it at school. But basically, what scared me about him was that I thought he was difficult to morally defend, very difficult to morally defend. He called white people devils and sort of broad-brushed all of them. And what capped it for me later in his life, unfortunately, is that he went to Mecca, came back, told all of us about this conversion, and my reaction to it was, Malcolm, I'd never met the man, but Malcolm, I could have told you that before you went. I myself knew a lot of blonde, blue-eyed Muslims, so I thought he was quite naive in just finding out after his trip to Mecca that there were other Muslims around the world of different hues and shades. But basically, being a Southerner, and I suspect that has a lot to do with it, I thought the principles that I grew up in the black church and had a very ecumenical look on life, Martin Luther King was more to my liking. But as a young college student, very aware of the inequities in our society, Malcolm certainly spoke and vocalized the rage that I felt about this injustice.
So Arthur Ashe there as a caller to this show on Martin Luther King Day, 1993, and we were just getting going. We will play the rest of the call in a few minutes. There's actually more to come than you just heard, a larger share of it, when we get into Malcolm X and contemporary pop culture, and Ashe tells the story of Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali as well. But with me now is Jeannie Mutusami Ashe, who married Arthur in 1977, and I am very honored. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
You know, I got goosebumps when one of my all-time heroes called in that day, and I've been getting goosebumps again listening to it last night and this morning for the first time in years. Does that conversation reflect something that you recognize as being quintessentially Arthur?
Vintage Arthur, definitely. It was very, very important on many counts. And one thing, when you were kind enough, and I thank you so much and everyone here at WNYC for allowing us to air this broadcast on arthurashe.org on the website. But what it does is, for me, is on January 18th, which was Martin Luther King Day, Arthur called in from the hospital, but he was being released from the hospital that day. So what I heard when I first heard this broadcast, I started thinking, I've got to go back and look in his date book, because his voice sounded passionate but somewhat weak.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew, you know, obviously remembering that period of time, that you know, this was either the day that he had gotten out of the hospital or very close to the time when he was being let out of the hospital, having just spent a month in there. But what's so vintage and compelling about Arthur is that the entire time he was in the hospital is he stayed fully engaged in the world.
Well, he was obviously engaged with that program and really blew me away with the depth of his analysis and ability to talk at, I could also hear, I had interviewed him once before on another topic, so I had heard his voice personally, and I could hear that hoarseness or that breaking up of his voice, so
right.
I wondered if there was something respiratory going on with him, but of course his level of analysis and level of moral analysis was unbelievable, as it always was. I have read that Arthur said if he was remembered primarily as a tennis player, he would feel he was a failure. Is that how he felt?
Definitely. I think that there were so many important issues on his plate that I think Arthur always had the mission of using tennis as a platform to be able to talk about the inequities in life, having grown up in segregated Richmond, Virginia, as he did. So he used that platform very well. He happened to be a really good tennis player. And
you don't win three of the majors around the world, including the U.S. Open.
Not bad.
Without being a good But he felt he was using that in the service of something larger.
Oh, no question about it. No question about it. I mean, the issues go on. And one of the reasons that I think it's so important to me that you would offer this recording, Brian, is that the importance of arthurashe.org and what I wanted to create through that website was the ability for Arthur to be able to tell his own story. And when you hear how he felt coming from him and the privilege of having this audio recording from January 18th, 2.5 weeks before he died.
I was shocked, of course, when I heard it, because he had sounded so good.
Yep.
And oh my God, he died?
2.5 weeks later. But it just shows, through Arthur, you and I don't have to tell this story. I mean, you, by lending this and enabling the website to run the story, people who were not, who either didn't hear this recording or didn't know, this new generation of people who really didn't know Arthur Ashe but only knew of him as a tennis player who died of AIDS,
That's right.
Will have this opportunity to hear him firsthand how passionate he was about so many issues.
And not in an organized prefab speech, but
exactly.
something that he was moved to call in with spontaneously.
Exactly.
And, you know, I was thinking that the anniversaries this year are so many in relation to this call. This
Indeed.
Is 40 years since Arthur won the U.S. Open.
Indeed.
40 years since King was assassinated.
Indeed.
40 years, I believe, since South Africa denied him entry. And he
Just
became,
about.
I was think it was 68 also?
69-70.
69-70. Okay, so not quite. 15 years, of course, since Arthur passed away. He said on that call that we just played that he talked about Malcolm X in college a lot, maybe every day.
Hmm.
Did you know him then?
Oh, no. I didn't know him when he was in college. I was a blip on the screen. but I believe that that is true just because when he was attending UCLA in California, coming from Richmond, Virginia, I think that Arthur loved conversation. He loved, and you wouldn't say that he argued, but he liked lively conversation. So I think the curiosity of being in the environment of UCLA, coming from Richmond, Virginia, although his senior year of high school, he was at Sumner High in St. Louis, Missouri, because he was not allowed to, play tennis in Richmond at the
Wow.
time against other really good competitive players. So his father, he and his father made the decision for him to go to St. Louis. But when he found himself having been invited by his coach, J.D. Morgan, at UCLA to play tennis for UCLA, he also found himself in a position that not just as a tennis player, but in the 60s, being in college around a variety of people, a diverse group of people, and this was the kind of format Arthur thrived in.
Did it surprise you at all, hearing this tape for the first time this week, how critical he was of Malcolm in that part of the call? He had said he found Malcolm frightening. He used that word. He was scared by him, used that word. And that when Malcolm came back from Mecca and suddenly saw everybody as one, Arthur thought, well, yeah, I could have told you that before you went. I mean, that was a pretty cheeky thing to say.
I'm laughing because, again, that's really vintage Arthur. And I think that you have to appreciate the eloquence of Arthur. But at the same time, I think that was something that a lot of people didn't like about him. But at the same time, Arthur was speaking about a specific period of time and how he felt. And I'm a northerner from the south side of Chicago. And Arthur, having been married to, I was married to a southerner for those 17 years, I learned something about southerners. And they do navigate in the world differently than we northerners do.
Did you two debate Malcolm X?
Not really debate Malcolm X, but I could keep you here all day on the things we did debate about. but I think the point that I was trying to make is that at that time, the African-American community was, for the lack of using another word, angry. Martin Luther King had been taken away from us in 1968. And Malcolm appealed to, as Arthur said, that northern urban experience in a way that was empowering the black community. As Dr. Cohn in the interview so eloquently addresses, but he empowers the black community with his words and at the same time isolated the white community. And the black community was ready to, they were angry, upset. Our most poignant leader was actually taken from us at that point. And Arthur was completely inclusionary.
So in a few minutes, we will play the rest of that call where Arthur continues to talk about morality. Interesting how many times you use that word in the 11-minute call. And more there about contemporary morality in this case coming up. He concerned himself frequently with questions of what was moral. We'll hear him tell a story of Malcolm X's influence on Muhammad Ali, as he saw it, pop culture, people in those days running around with X's on their hats and stuff like that. So Jeannie Mutusami Ashe, you'll come back with us in a couple of minutes, and we'll hear more of Arthur Ashe's call to this show on Martin Luther King Day, 1993. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue now with photographer Jeannie Matusami Ash, widow of Arthur Ash. She is here to replay with us the phone call that Arthur Ash made to the show as a listener on Martin Luther King Day, 1993. And let's hear the rest of the call. This is about another 5 minutes. Again, the guest is James Cone, C-O-N-E, author of the book Martin and Malcolm and America. We pick it up where I asked Arthur about Malcolm and contemporary culture. Arthur Ash, what's your reaction to the pop culture aspects of Malcolm X today? You probably see young kids wearing Malcolm X caps and Malcolm X sweatbands on the tennis courts and whatnot.
That's right. I understand it. And we are a faddish people as far as our youngsters are concerned, and I understand that. And I think because for a large segment of the African-American population, the growing underclass that William Julius Wilson talks about so much, nothing has changed so much. In fact, I'm sure Professor Cohen would say that things have actually gotten worse for them as people like myself, who are educated and could take advantage of these new openings that popped up as a result of the Voting Rights and Civil Rights Act, as we took advantage of these opportunities, we moved away from traditional neighborhoods where we all lived in the same place, and we left this underclass by themselves. Now, they just sort of festered. They were leaderless, no role models, no people to really look out for them. And as a result, they are still now looking for another Malcolm to come in and vocalize their concerns. But one other point I wanted to make, and I know you got to go to some other callers. Mm-hmm. One of my biggest disappointments is that the black political movement, in a broad way, has lost its moral underpinning. I thought at the very beginning of the 60s, not just because of Dr. King, we had the moral high ground. We could look anyone in the eye and say, what we are trying to do, what we are trying to accomplish is right, it's just, it's long overdue, and there is no excuse for not helping us to achieve it. But someplace in the late 60s and early 70s, it became strictly political. The moral underpinnings, as far as I'm concerned, were sort of wiped away, Machiavellian almost. And so now it's very difficult for these. I'll just give you one last example. I was watching the revolt from L.A. last spring. On CNN in the middle of the day, they had one Crip and one Blood, the two gangs out there. And they were talking about their reaction to Reginald Denny, the white truck driver, being pulled out of his truck and beaten nearly half to death. And some call-in, like this show, so what's your reaction to that? And they both said, oh, it doesn't mean anything to me. My reaction was, as I said to my wife, that's not us. That is not us. And if that had happened in the mid-60s even, the reaction would not have been like that. And so I just think that somehow we have to regain the moral underpinning for whatever we would like to do politically and philosophically.
How do you think?
I don't know, because obviously the influence of the black church has diminished greatly. And as Malcolm himself mentioned, he is the creature of the northern urban experience. He had very little experience, firsthand or otherwise, with southern living. And he also spoke to those people, black people, in the north. I suspect if Malcolm had come south with some of those same things, they would have turned him away. I mean, I just really believe that. I mean, you would have had a contingent of young, angry people who would have listened. But even if he had gone to some of the black colleges in the South with some of that, first of all, I am convinced the administrators at some of these black Southern schools wouldn't have wanted Malcolm to come and talk like that in the 60s. But Malcolm, I just thought, as much as I was, arrested and attracted to his rhetoric, really, I thought, was a bit more a creature, not a creature, maybe the wrong choice of words, but a product of a northern urban experience. Even though, as Dr. Cohen said, he tried to look at things internationally. But again, I really thought he was just naive when he came back from Mecca and said, I'm changed. And my reaction then was, Malcolm, I could have told you that before you left.
Yes, I agree much of what Arthur Ashe has said, but I do think it's important to see both Martin King and Malcolm X as moral forces, but they were more forces in different contexts. I think the power of King's message was suddenly grounded in the black church and in the South, and that's the context in which he carried out his moral force, as it were. The context of Malcolm X, of course, is in the North, as Arthur Ashe has said, but he also was a moral force, but primarily a moral force in the African-American community and helping African-Americans realize that their respect for themselves is as important as it is to respect whites, which King emphasized. So you have two different forces at work. There's no need to choose between them. We must see them in relation to each other.
Well, let me make one other comment. It's an obvious example I'm very, very familiar with. Malcolm X met a young boxer named Cassius Clay in the early 60s. And Cassius Clay, like me, brought up in the South, Louisville, Kentucky, middle-class home, both mother and father present. He made a conversion to Islam, and then after he did that, we know in 67 he refused induction to the U.S. Army and his athletic career suffered. The point I'm just going to make here is that Cassius Clay, I don't think, would not have done that. Muhammad Ali did it, and I think that's an example of the sort of backbone that someone like Malcolm X instilled in some people like Cassius Clay to enable them, to give them the nerve, the daring, the audacity to take that extra step, which some people thought would not be taken had they been led strictly by Martin Luther King.
Arthur Ashe, eloquent as always, and thanks a lot for giving us a little treat here by calling up. Thank you. And
thank you. I can turn my radio back on.
You may. You have our permission. Thank you very much. Arthur Ashe's call to this show, Martin Luther King Day, 1993. His widow, the photographer Jeannie Ashe, is with us as we turn over a copy of that phone call for the archives that she has launched on the new website, arthurashe.org. We will talk a little bit more about that website in a minute. We have maybe 5 minutes for phone calls for Jeannie Ashe, and our lines are open, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, for anyone who wants to say anything about Arthur Ashe as an inspirational figure in or out of sports, or reaction to anything that you heard in that phone call, 212-433-9692. Were you surprised in that clip to hear Arthur say the civil rights movement had lost its moral underpinnings?
No. First of all, because Arthur, as I mentioned before, loved good conversation, but he also provoked thought. And I think what's important here to recognize is that in 1968, the images that we saw on television were of the civil rights movement. What we saw on television that was happening in L.A. in 1993 that Arthur was referring to.
The L.A. riots after Rodney King was convicted.
Exactly. Here you have a Southerner who watched 1968 unfolding, the civil rights movement. And when Arthur said in 1993, that's not us, those are not the images we saw in 1968. It was completely the opposite. It was a nonviolent, peaceful movement. And what we saw in 1993 was completely the opposite and very much of a Northern experience.
Florette in Flatbush. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay, great, because I'm on the speakerphone, so I'm trying to get dressed and get out of here. But I wanted to tell you that in 1993, it was my last year of teaching the second grade, and my feelings for Ashe as a tennis player and an outstanding individual were just enormous. And then I happened to hear this broadcast. I don't know if it was in the day or the evening, when you had the repeat, because I was teaching.
Yeah.
But I was so affected.
You heard it. You heard it when it originally broadcast, you're saying.
Yeah, because it was 1993. I was still teaching.
Uh-huh.
I hadn't retired yet. But I shared it with the loss with my children when I found out that he died. I knew he was dying, but, I didn't know he would leave us so quickly. And I told them, I showed them his photo, and I spoke to them a little bit about him. And then, when we finished, I found I couldn't just put it away. I cut out some construction paper, made a little frame, and I put it up on the blackboard so that his presence would be with us. And then I left it up for, a very long time. And during that conversation, you know, he mentioned Malcolm X, and my brother, when Malcolm X was first becoming popular with the public, my brother was a lieutenant with him, and he rode with him all the time. Mm-hmm. And we were Catholics, and my mother was all upset, and trying to understand.
Floretta, it's a great story, and I have to leave it there because our time is limited to get some other people on. She has, by the way, the clearest speakerphone I've ever heard. Nobody else is allowed to use a speakerphone when talking on the air except Florette. But that's great that the call was remembered and had an impact on teaching a second grade class.
Can I just ask Florette one question? Your kids, second grade, were 8 years old?
Some of them six, going to be seven.
Okay.
And then they'd be seven when they went into the – they'd be eight when they went into the third grade.
Because, my daughter was 6 years old when my husband passed away. And I think what you did, if more teachers had done that, to have emphasized Arthur's impact on the community and his thoughts and to allow him to speak them and to give these kids a different perspective of Arthur Ashe other than as a tennis player, is I applaud you. It's terrific. And I really am... We should be blessed that we have teachers like you. Thank you.
And listeners like you. Florette, thank you. John in Glen Cove, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hey. Great to talk to you both. I want to thank you, Leonard, and you, Mrs. Ashe, for...
It's Brian, but I'll thank Leonard, too, when he comes on. It's okay.
It's so hard after so many years.
That's all right. Go ahead.
I'm thrown off with that Steve Post. I just want to thank you both for...
Steve Post, Saturdays from 4 to 5, by the way, but go ahead.
But that's not morning music. To bring this great expression of spirit and of this time on President Lincoln's birthday, because you mentioned diversity, and I'm thinking of Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals.
Right, and I'm gonna, which is a book about Lincoln, and you know, we didn't plan it that way, but it did come out that we're having this conversation, Jeannie, on what used to be called Lincoln's birthday, February 12th, before it all got assimilated into President's Day. I loved how, even after all that criticism of Malcolm X, Arthur in the phone call was then able to turn around at the end of the call and praise Malcolm for helping give Cassius Clay the backbone that he needed to resist the draft by helping him become Muhammad Ali, which to me just reflected the moral complexity with which your husband was willing to think and communicate, not just with us or against us.
I think that's what made Arthur such an engaging individual to talk to, because he saw things from a lot of different points of view, not just one.
So what would make Arthur happy in our last minute here in terms of keeping his legacy alive? What would make him think he was being remembered in a way that he found meaningful, and how can any of the listeners help you with the new website, arthurashe.org?
First, let me say, vote. That's the most important thing, and I think Arthur would agree with that, because...
Do you want to go all the way and say he would have been inspired by Obama as a black man talking about unity?
First of all, I want to say he would be inspired by the fact that an African-American male and a woman are both running for the Democratic candidacy. I think he would applaud both of those visions. So, because that's who he was.
So vote for the candidate of your choice.
Vote for the candidate of your choice. But 1968, this country changed 40 years ago. And Arthur played a role in that by winning the very first U.S. Open. 40 years later, 2008, this country is facing change. Big change. And I think that is so momentum to who he was in promoting change and wanting, the best for all that he fought for and all of the issues that he fought for.
Jeannie Ashe, it's been a real honor to meet you. I'm delighted that you're going to archive that phone call on arthurashe.org. Of course, people can also hear it on wnyc.org. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for the opportunity. Go to www.arthurashe.org.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up, we continue our Food for Thought series today on corn. Stay tuned.